welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller Podcast for the 11th day of November 2019. It's a Monday. It is a holiday. It is Veterans Day. If you have a veteran in your life, make sure you give them a little tip of the cap today. Or call them up. Let them know you're thinking about them. Thank them for their service. If you see somebody you know is a veteran, you don't even know them well, let them know you're thinking about them. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening, telling a friend, tuning in, and all that good stuff. As it is a holiday, I am taking the liberty of running my favorite interview, one of my favorite guests, Sean Parnell. He's been on the show twice so far, and he's announced he's running for Congress just outside of Pittsburgh against Connor Lamb, the Democrat. He's got to win the primary first, of course, but I thought it's Veterans Day. He's a veteran. It's a holiday, so we can sort of take it a little bit easy today and come back roaring tomorrow, and let's revisit with Sean Parnell. So that's what we did today. We have the interviews with Sean Parnell where we talk to him about his books, the best-selling Outlaw Platoon, Man of War, and All Out War, his two thrillers. He's working on part three, which I hope isn't delayed too much by a run for Congress, but I hope he wins that seat in Congress, because Lord knows what I know about Sean Parnell. You could use more people like Sean Parnell in Congress. If you missed either one of these interviews, you're going to get to hear them both in their entirety. And I suspect you will come away thinking the way I do, that maybe we could use a Sean Parnell in Congress. Certainly could use a lot more people with his attitude and love of country and devotion to service up there in Washington. God, Lord knows we could use that. So that's what we did. For those of you who emailed home remedies and things like that for Quinn's stoppage problem, the dam has broken. Thank you, first of all. The dam has broken, really broken, like broken. Damn. But things are flowing normally again. She's no longer crying, so that is good. Actually, I sat and watched a movie with her for the first time ever, and she was able to hold her focus and not run around. She narrated it. She's turning into a little Morgan Freeman. She narrates everything. But for the most part, she watched the movie, asked questions, pointed out things. It was great. Very much looking forward to being, I'm still not ready to take her to the theater, but I'm looking forward to being able to take her to the theater when I'm convinced she can sit still for an hour and a half without ruining the movie experience for all the other kids in the theater. Plus, I've never been to a theater for a kids movie. The other kids would probably ruin it, which, again, don't really want. Anyway, before we get to Sean Parnell, we tip our cap to our sponsor. Look, I'm a firm believer that when you're healthy, you're happy. And that's why I use CBD oil from AncientLifeOil.com. It's a natural remedy made with nothing but the purest ingredients and blended with coconut and hemp oils. I'm telling you, it's a home run hitter for your health. Look, I was a skeptic, just like you are, I'm sure. But now I see why it's so popular. I feel great. It really works. Ancient Life Oil is non-psychoactive, meaning it provides you with all the benefits without the high. And I know you're sitting there skeptical. I encourage you to do your own research. Just search CBD oil benefits for yourself. Find out why tens, if not hundreds of thousands of your fellow Americans by this point have made CBD oil a regular part of their healthy routine. If you're ready to live your best life, go to AncientLifeOil.com now, the trusted source for the highest quality CBD oil. A-N-C-I-E-N-T, LifeOil.com. That's AncientLifeOil.com. Use promo code Derek at checkout, and you get free shipping. Find out what all the fuss is about. It's showing up everywhere and selling all over the place, not because people are stupid, not because people are crazy, but because we're on to something. AncientLifeOil.com, promo code Derek for free shipping at checkout. Okay, the first time Sean Parnell was on the show, I thought, this guy does, I bet he needs a beer. I want to have a beer with Sean Parnell. I knew his history of service as a ranger in Afghanistan, and I thought, I'm going to give this guy a beer while we talk. And that was a good call. It's a good call. That's why it's been a part of the other time he's been on the show. And I tell you, talking to the guy off camera, off mic, is, it's just the same. He is who he is, and you get what you see, what you get what you see. It is, he's the real deal. So here it is from September of 2018, Sean Parnell talking about his very first novel, talking about the war on terror, talking about his service in Afghanistan, and his best-selling book, Outlaw Platoon. I think, in fact, I know you'll like it. Ladies and gentlemen, Sean Parnell, New York Times best-selling author, former Army Ranger, and dad, which is most important. Welcome to the program.
Hey,
Sean.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got beer for you.
I come into an interview, and the first thing that you hand me is beer. We are off to a very, very good start.
If you turned it down, heroin was next. So I don't know. You asked for the Yingling. You had a choice between Budweiser and Yingling. Why Yingling?
I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm a Pittsburgh boy, blue-collar guy, born and raised in the city. Yingling is what I've drank my entire life. Well, from 21 on, it's what I've drank. But I love Yingling, and I love Pittsburgh. I love everything to do with the city, all the sports teams.
And so you're a Steelers fan.
Huge Steelers fan.
Isn't that tough?
I'm still, yeah.
Hey, I grew up in Detroit. We don't have a pro team. We just have the Lions.
I'm still very sad about the tie.
How do you tie Cleveland?
I know. Look.
Cleveland.
I knew it was coming. I had a feeling. Cleveland. Listen. Cleveland is.
You almost lost to Cleveland.
I know.
That's the worst part.
I'm just saying. I knew it was coming. Cleveland has a good team. They were a few, like, critical players
has a good team.
Last year, they were, like, sort of missing out on the quarterback, missing out on a strong running back. Now they have both. And so, as you probably know, all it takes is one great, solid game manager of a quarterback to turn a team around. And I think, you know, Tyrod Taylor can be that guy. He's mobile enough, and he's a good enough pass threat that keeps the linebackers in check. So, I'm making excuses.
If that lets you sleep at night, you do whatever you need to sleep at night after tying Cleveland. But Detroit got their ass handed to them on Monday Night Football, so I got nothing to talk about.
Yeah, they really did. But everyone sort of expects that.
Our quarterback is very consistent at throwing to the other team.
Well, Matt Stafford is good if your offensive line could actually protect him. He could spend most of the game on his back.
Or if you're the other team. He's very good. He makes really straight, right in the breadbasket, he throws that ball to the other team. All right, I want to talk to you first about how a guy from Pittsburgh ends up being an Army Ranger.
Okay. Okay.
How does that happen?
Well, okay, so I was just a college kid when 9/11 happened. I was a sophomore. I think I was an elementary education major, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Nobody does.
Yeah, the only thing I was majoring in was alcohol consumption. And so
legally at the age of 21.
Yeah, correct.
As a sophomore.
Correct.
We're
and so
do the math on that.
I remember one morning I woke up on my couch surrounded by beer cans and stagger over to the TV set and I turn it on just in time to see an airplane crash into the World Trade Center. And I don't know, man. I just feel like my whole life was boiled down to that moment, and within seconds, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I was angry. Like most everybody that witnessed 9/11.
Right. Well, I was pissed. I remember that rage every year on September 11th.
You probably remember exactly where you were and exactly what you were doing.
I do.
So same with me. And I just knew for me, it was like I wanted to join the infantry, and then I wanted to go to airborne school, and then I wanted to go to Ranger school, and I wanted to get in the fight as fast as humanly possible and be a part of America's collective response. And I got my chance, and we went to past all my schools by the skin of my teeth and for some of them, but I made it through all the cool schools that the Army had to offer and that the Army threw at me, and I found myself in combat for not just a year. I was in combat for 16 months, heavy combat on the front lines.
Leading the 10th Mountain Division years old, was it?
Yeah, part of the 10th Mountain Division, like my unit was on the front lines in the trenches the whole time, so you know, Easy Company of the 101st Airborne jumped into Normandy and fought to Hitler's Eagle's Nest in less time than 485 days, which is the amount of time that we were in Afghanistan. So, I mean, we never left. My base took over 3,000 rockets. We got shot at every day. It was absolute hell.
In doing some research about you, I was watching some archival footage of you and your platoon mates and some news reports and things. You guys had to use yourself as bait a lot of times.
All the time.
Basically, just kind of one around pretending, hey, we're just sitting here playing ping pong or something. Come attack us. You tried to draw them out.
Yeah.
That, I think, is the most puzzling part or most bizarre part that people watching would think. You had to try and get shot at in order to engage the enemy in combat. What is the thought process of somebody not coming up with that idea, because I imagine whoever came up with that idea was sitting in an office somewhere.
I have to
execute that idea.
I'll tell you exactly where it came from. The enemy that we were fighting over there was not farmers with pitchforks. These guys or like hardened jihadist fighters or hardened mujahideen that fought against the Russians in the 80s. They fought in the Afghan Civil War in the 90s and then against us in a post 9/11 era. And, you know, these mujahideen in Afghanistan, when we first got there, some of the old guys that fought against the Russian told us that the average mujahideen fighter has 18 or 20 years combat experience on an average 18-year-old American private. So these guys knew that we got into Afghanistan. They knew the terrain better than we did.
Right.
You know, they were well-trained. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they were really, really hard to find. And so I remember in our very first engagement, it was May 7th, 2006, the first time I ever got shot at. We were coming around, just to give you a sense of how good these guys are, we're coming around this big mountaintop, right? As soon as we came around, we dipped low into the valley system, into this sort of like, looked like a gravy boat. The enemy attacked us right at that point because they knew that our comms were line of sight and we wouldn't be able to communicate with our base. They opened up on us with RPGs.
So they're...
They knew exactly what they were doing.
Do you think the American people understand how intelligent they are? Maybe they're not goat farmers, but they're just backwoods people who are, you know, live in tents and just are savages, and that's it. Their savagery is it. But there's actual serious intelligent thought behind their actions.
And we actually sat down across from some of them, like just at the negotiating table. They're fierce, man, and they take pride in their tactical acumen that they bring to the battlefield, man, that they can display. It's on display every day over there. But, I mean, think about it. They hit us. They knocked out our front truck. They knocked out my back truck. They had us trapped in the low ground, opened up on us with three machine gun positions on either side of us and just pounded us. And so that was the first time I was ever under fire.
You write about this in your first book.
Yes.
This book is a thriller. This is a fiction book. The first book was a recounting. It's called Outlaw Platoon, big New York Times bestseller. When you're sitting down, what made you decide to write that? Was it just in you percolating and you had to get it out where you recount this? Or did somebody come to you after having a couple of drinks and hearing your stories and saying, you know what, you should write this? Where did the idea come from?
Yeah, no. So my guys would go home on leave. You get 2 weeks break in a combat deployment called R&R, rest and relaxation. And then they'd go home and Americans would be like, oh, thank you for your service. You know, where were you deployed? And they'd be like, Afghanistan. And they'd be like, oh, thank God you were in Afghanistan and not Iraq, because Iraq was just so dangerous. And if you remember back at the time, 2006, the eyes of the nation were wholeheartedly focused on the debate over Iraq.
Right.
Should we be there or not? Should we send in more troops for the surge and so it was before the surge. And so to everybody in this country and
Afghanistan seemed like it was peaceful.
It was
taken care of.
Yeah, but it wasn't. And like, man, we got thrown into a meat grinder. And so I just wanted to like make sure that when I got back, I was able to capture the legacy that my soldier, the heroism and capture the legacy on the page for Americans to read. You know, Americans can pick up Outlaw Platoon 100 years from now and recognize the sacrifice.
It's required reading at West Point.
Don't ask me why. I can barely pass college myself.
Hey, somebody has written a book. If anybody wants to use my book as a textbook, I'm all for it. Let alone anything. If your community college wants it, we'll cut you a deal on the price. Forget West Point. That ain't going to happen.
I barely graduated college. So, I mean, I don't know how. I mean,
When you sit down to write this book, do you call the members of your platoon and say, hey, I'm thinking about this. You got to make sure that they're cool. These are your brothers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Make sure they're cool with you saying
100%.
This.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Outlaw Platoon did not have a political axe to grind. It didn't have an axe to grind against anybody, whether it was politics or otherwise. But, you know, you want to make sure that you get it. You describe events as accurate as possible. And everybody experiences engagements differently, you know. So you want to make sure that you get their perspective. So, yeah, of course, I talked to them a lot, you know, and if a part of the book had them in it, I talked to them about it first.
And they were all cool with it? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So it comes out, it's a huge success. Were you caught by surprise?
Yes.
What's that like when you wake up in the morning and your agent is calling you and saying, hey, man, New York Times bestselling author is now a moniker that's going to hang on you forever?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, I certainly didn't expect it. It hit the New York Times list in its first week on sale, and then I think was in its first year was on the Times list for 28 weeks, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a
You're
little
a barely literate guy from Pennsylvania whose football team ties the Browns. And here you are on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what about that story seems to resonate with people. You know, it's a human story. I mean, Outlaw Platoon is in 10 countries and it's a quintessentially American story, but it sells in China and in Poland.
Would you say it's a story of heroism or bravery or just a sort of documenting what happened?
I think
people are craving
I think it's a story.
Heroes.
Yeah, I think it's a story of heroism and bravery, and really, it's a human story. It's about, I mean, almost every single day, somebody writes me about who their favorite member of the platoon was. It really is their story. It's really a triumph of the human spirit about what human beings can accomplish when under duress if they come together.
Before we get to the new book, I was again doing research on you this morning, cyber stalking you. Don't go through my internet history. Don't go past today either.
Yeah.
Really awkward to explain. But I saw a video blog that you did where you sort of, you don't like being referred to as a combat veteran.
Right.
Because you think that that pigeonholes you. Talk a little bit about that. Because a lot of, whenever anybody sees anybody in a military or a former military, there's this societal pressure to run up and give them a hug, buy them a sandwich.
Exactly.
Say, thank you for this. You say no.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a part of my life 10 years ago. I mean, are you the same person that you were in high school?
Sadly, yes.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Well, you just blew my point out of the water.
Yeah,
but the point I'm trying to make is like, the war shaped me, and the training that I had shaped who I am today, but it doesn't define who I am today. Mm-hmm. Like, I went through absolute hell in Afghanistan. It was really hard, but I also had some of the best experiences of my life there. And so I just don't like being treated as, you know, like anytime Fox News calls me or anybody else calls me, and I totally get it.
It's
always about engagement in RC East Afghanistan.
War on terror.
You know? And it's like, it sort of whittles you down to like something that you were over 10 years ago for me.
Right.
And I, by the way, totally cool with going on the news and talking about that stuff, but I am more than that, you know?
Do you think that's common amongst your fellow veterans?
I do. I think it's...
When somebody comes up to you and says, thank you for your service, I assume part of you appreciates that, but at some point you just got to say enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course I appreciate it, you know, and you know, because part of my mission in life is to try to bring people that enjoy freedom every day closer to the people that protect it. You know, with like the percentage of veterans has gone down since World War II. Those people that serve in this, it's like 0.4%.
People serve. Now.
It's like less than half of 1% or something crazy low, and so you know, I think anytime you can bring civilians closer to veterans, it makes the country a little bit better. It makes people appreciate their freedom more. But you know, for me, like that's who I was. It's part of who I was, but it's not who I am now. And I'm trying to move past. I'm trying to it will always be part of me, but I'm trying to move on to other
things. Last question before we get to Eric Steele and Man of War. I read on your website about spinal fluid leaking from your ear and you're still leading people into combat.
Yeah.
What the hell, man?
I know. I mean, I get flack for this a lot, but in 2006, like traumatic brain injury, the whole TBI, it wasn't even an acronym. And so
now I'm wondering the logistics. How the hell does spinal fluid come out your ear?
I ended up having three small hairline fractures on my skull, and the cerebral spinal fluid was leaking out of my nose and my ears. And so the fractures healed on their own, but you know, it took a while. It took a couple weeks.
Scary. Well, thank you for your service. Now, your first book is a recounting of what really happened. Then you go to Man of War.
Yeah.
And you create a character named Steele, Eric Steele.
Yeah.
How do you make the transition? Because, you know, you wrote this one by yourself. The first one, you sort of had guide.
I did.
Co-author.
For sure. Taught me the ropes.
How do you decide I'm going to go fiction? Because I'm sure you could have written another story, another realistic story.
Yeah.
You couldn't put everything into one book.
Well, I'll tell you exactly why. I mean, I feel like there is a void in our culture today of mainstream action heroes that just love this country and believe freedom is worth dying for, and is worth protecting. And you know, I grew up with films like Indiana Jones, where a freaking dude is punching Nazis. I grew up with that. Who doesn't want to punch a Nazi? You know, and then Marty McFly, you know, and Back to the Future. They were like the best movie, but our generation doesn't have heroes like that.
Just
keep Hollywood and you just keep rebooting the same things over and over again. MacGyver, Hawaii Five-0, it's like the same old stuff all the time, right? And so I just feel like it's really important to give our kids who pick up and read books fictional heroes that are good, that love the country, that are pro-American. You know, all I'll say is that there's a void out there right now in this genre and in mainstream fiction and in mainstream entertainment. There's not enough characters that love and appreciate.
And so you created one.
And so I created.
Now, I've written some fiction. I've started. I have a lot of ideas rattling around in my vacant skull. And I find that as I flesh them out more, they mostly become masturbatory exercises in self-congratulation for me. You know, like, there's always a part with character that I identify as myself, and he's super cool. And it's like, yeah, yeah. Bullshit, and I shelve it. Is Eric Steele Sean Parnell?
A little bit.
A little bit?
A little bit. I mean, so the bad guy in this book is a guy named Nathaniel West, and so Eric Steele was the guy that I always aspired to be in combat as a leader, you know? Moral compass intact. Eric Steele's a guy that runs to the flames and not away from them. He believes that he can save people preserve innocent life if he can. Even if there's a ticking time bomb, if there's some time left on that clock and Eric can divert the mission to save somebody, he will. Nathaniel West, on the other hand, is the guy that sometimes I wish I could have been in combat and just unleashed everything. Sometimes you just get so frustrated and it's so primal and you're so savage that you just wish, if you just like let go of all the moral components of your psyche, I would have become Nate West in combat. And so Nate West, the villain in this book, is a part of me as well.
How do you make that decision and put it, is it cathartic to put it into fiction where you have a situation, I imagine, with all the combat that you saw, it's like, we have a mission, we have to get to here or stop this, but then there's these kids over here, there's some civilians or something, we can save some innocent lives or accomplish the mission, which is a horrible choice to be put in, because your job is to complete your mission. How do you make that decision, and how does that play into this book?
You know, I'm really impressed with that question, because that's the theme of this book. Sometimes you can't save everybody, you know, for Eric Steele.
How do you accept that? Or do you?
I never did. We were always able to accomplish our mission. I mean, we never hurt any civilians. And if we could have saved people along the way, look, we were never on missions where there was a ticking time bomb, right? We had to be on target certain times to get certain high-value targets. But if we could stop along the way to help people, we always did. And, you know, part of our mission in Afghanistan, you know, well, a main component of was to close with and destroy and kill the enemy. But another major component of that was taking care of the Afghan civilians, because we needed them. We need them to win the war. And so we did that. And, you know, but you're right. At the end of the day, you know, if your back is up against the wall, it's always mission first, 100% all the time. Even if you have soldiers bleeding out on the battlefield, your job is to complete the mission first. And that's how we're trained. And ultimately, that is what Eric Steele learns that in this book, that sometimes, you know, you're given two pretty terrible situations. One is completing the mission and the other one, you know what I mean? Like you're putting, like sometimes completing the mission means like a terrible decision. You know,
it really is an unenviable situation. What do you want people to come away from, not learning, but feeling from this? You got all the bigwigs in the thriller genre praising you. Brad Thor loves you. You got Lee Child.
Really lucky.
You.
I'm really lucky. I don't know. I mean, it's my first book, so I feel really
the first in a series.
First in a franchise series, hopefully. Yeah. And, you know, I wanted Americans to, like, I experienced a lot of combat. I put a lot of it in here too, you know, and I turned the volume up to 10 on all of it. So there's a lot of action for people that like entertainment and stuff like that. It's also accurate, you know, it feels authentic. And
Is it set in the real world, set in now, not an alternate universe different from ours?
Well, no, exactly. It's set in the real world. I mean, with fictional characters, obviously, but I created a clandestine world that was a part of our own, you know, that was inspired and born out of my experience in Afghanistan. We go after high value targets. It'd be like, we know the guy's in that compound right over there. Like, we know he takes his kids to school on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Can we go get him? And like 24 hours later, you hear from Washington, D.C., like, yeah, go get him. And by the time you get there, he's gone. And so I'm like, what if we had a unit that had no oversight, reported directly to the president? And what if we called that unit the Alpha Program? And what if 9 alphas were responsible for a different geographic area of the globe? And so that's sort of, Eric Steele is the youngest alpha.
Are the rules of engagement the biggest obstacle you face over there, or one of the biggest?
It became one of the biggest. In 2006, we were allowed to handle it on the ground. And because of that, we killed 350 enemy soldiers and not one civilian. And in my opinion, we had the war won in Afghanistan in 2007 with one brigade combat team in Regional Command East. And it was in 2008 where there was a drastic shift of policy from counterterror to counterinsurgency. And we lost the initiative and might have lost the war. We're in a situation now where we win every battle on the ground, but somehow we're losing the war.
Yeah, well, we decided we want to make friends.
That's it. That's exactly right.
That's the problem. Yep, that's Sean Parnell, right. The book, Man of War. I know you have a hard out. I'm going to ask you to sign these copies, and you can win a copy. Email Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com, and you can win one of these signed copies. And I'm going to ask you to draw two names from here to suckers who entered early this week to win a copy of my book signed. And read them out loud if you can.
Oh, I got to pronounce the names
right? Yeah, because I can't. I have dyslexia. I'm also stupid, so I wouldn't be able to do
all right.
One of them.
So, Leon Flint.
Leon Flint.
Just for proof, Leon Flint. I pronounced that right.
Our man Flint. Yeah, I don't think you can screw that one up. Even an army.
And Amy Gleason.
Amy Gleason. And Leon Flint. You now have to get married. I could be wrong on that. We'll fact check it, but I'll contact you and send you a signed copy of my book. It's a pleasure to meet you, man.
Nice to meet you,
too. I hope you had a good time.
I did.
And if you need another beer, we've got
Cheers. Yeah, thank you.
And good luck on this. Has Hollywood come calling yet for either one of the books?
Yes.
Outlaw Platoon would be right up their alley.
It is. I mean, it is. They're out there. I'll say that. We haven't picked a production company yet, but they're out there.
Last question, because I see we still have 2 minutes.
Of course.
Of all the movies that have been made about the War on Terror that come close to somewhere semblance, obviously nothing is your experience and nothing is anybody else's experience.
Sure.
If people want to get a sense of what it's like over there, has there been a movie that you've watched, or do you maybe not even watch the movies, where you say, there you go, your buddies at S, that's what it's like, that's as close as it's going to get to what it's like?
Well, I think if you want to watch, like, get a sense of what the infantry experience is, it doesn't really matter what generation that you're in. You watch Band of Brothers. It's by far, that will give you
it's incredible.
It's amazing. It's the infantry experience right there. And that's what I wanted to be a part of when I joined. But if you want to watch a movie about the global war on terror, I recommend American Sniper, only because it has the home front, too, which is a critically important part.
How hard was it hard for you? Did you have difficulty readjusting?
I mean, yeah, I think everybody that experiences combat comes home and feels like you feel different. And sometimes you can feel isolated, you know, almost like you're an exile in your own country, precisely because, you know, so few Americans serve. Mm-hmm. And most people don't really know what it takes to defend freedom. So you can feel isolated. I did as well. But I found it helpful to focus on something bigger than myself and help veterans when they come home. So
are you doing better now?
I am doing
even
better.
Even though the Steelers suck?
No, that sucks. That's bad. That's a bad point. I mean, I am doing better.
Sean Parnell, go buy the book, Man of War, and then try to win a copy by emailing me. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.
Don't try to win a copy because I don't have a copy to give you. That was from 2018, but go out and get a copy of his book for yourself. I love his novels. A book on tape is the way I recommend them because it's just like a movie, especially if you have like a long road trip or a series of road trips ahead of you. I recommend his books. They're freaking awesome on tape. Okay, so that was Sean Parnell. That was the first time I ever met Sean. A year later, he returned to the program with a new book, All Out War, the follow-up sequel to his novel, and he came back on the program. We had beer again, and we had another fascinating conversation where I think at the end I offer to give away more signed books. They're already gone. They've already been won, so don't enter again, but enjoy another interview with Sean Parnell. Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Daily Caller podcast. It is the 6th day of September, 2019. Summer's over, but that doesn't mean you don't have to get it out of your head and have a summer read. And that is the focus of our guest today. His name, he's a returning champion, as a matter of fact. It's Sean Parnell.
I am a returning champion.
You've been here before.
We have.
We got our beers. Yours is already open.
Bud Light, your favorite beer.
We tried to get
Bud Light
for you.
We tried
to get cheap Western Pennsylvania swill, but the liquor stores around the Daily Caller offices have standards. Not high standards, clearly, but standards nonetheless.
If you wanted, you should have gotten some Iron City beer, man. I'm from Pittsburgh. You know I love that stuff.
The trick is if I wanted, and I did not. Sean Parnell, he's the author of the best-selling book, Outlaw Platoon. He's the author of Man of War, which is what we talked to him about last year. And now the new thriller out just last Tuesday called All Out War.
This Tuesday.
This last Tuesday, because this is the Friday. We're doing this
This is for next Friday.
Oh my God! Do we have to re-record all?
How many beers are you in?
I'm sorry.
It doesn't matter. We show these
you
people.
I'm too stupid for all this.
You know what? Skip it. Show's over. Have a great weekend.
I'm sorry. I just totally.
You've had one and a half beers.
I totally fucked up your total.
You're
your whole
former,
intro.
Former Army Ranger, and one and a half Bud Lights put you on your ass.
I should have thought.
Kids today. No wonder we
I don't have a tolerance for beer. I'm sorry.
No wonder we can't win wars. People like you are out there fighting them. All right, I want to talk to you. It's an Eric Steele novel. It's your character. It's you. It's what you want to be when you grow up.
Yes.
It's pretty clear. He lives in the Pittsburgh area. He drinks Line and Kugel. He loves the Pittsburgh Steelers, which we don't hold against you, but it's still true.
It is true. After
Man of War. Well, first of all, I want to talk to you about the process before we get into All Out War.
Sure.
You go from, it's kind of a memoir of your time in Afghanistan in an outlaw platoon. What brings you to the world of fiction? Because I imagine this is, you know, it's a substantial book.
Yeah.
But I assume you have more stories. And people tell you more stories. If even you didn't have more stories yourself, you could have written other people's stories. But you decided to take that turn into fiction.
Well, so when I got back from Afghanistan, I realized something very, very quickly. And that was that there is a huge gap between the people that enjoy freedom on a day-to-day basis in this country and the people that protect it. I mean, I can't tell you. I've got countless stories from my guys who would come back from the war and then come back from their R&R, rest and relaxation leave, back to Afghanistan and say, you know, sir, oh my gosh, like Americans would ask, like, where were you deployed? And I'd answer Afghanistan. And they'd be like, oh my God, you're in Afghanistan. Thank God you're not in Iraq. It's just so dangerous there. And so my guys are like, Jesus Christ, I just got shot in the head last week. So something that became very apparent to me very quickly was that Americans don't know what's going on there. Right. And so I came back from Afghanistan thinking that I need to do something to capture the legacy of my troops. And that to me was, I've got to figure out a way to write a book and have it published the right way so that their heroism on the battlefield can be remembered and passed down from generation to generation to generation. And when Outlaw Platoon came out, I feel like no one expected the book to do well. I mean, I'm proud of this book. I put everything I had into this book. But I was a no-name guy jumping into a nonfiction world that untested waters for me. And it came out, and it was a New York Times bestseller in its first week and spent 28 weeks on the bestseller list in its first year, which is unbelievable. No one saw that coming. No one was more surprised than I was. And so after the book came out, I realized how much needed to be done for our men and women who are coming home from war. And so I dedicated my life to it. I've got a great charity that I work with. I'm part of a great charity that I work with that educates, inspires, and
you
gives
can
back.
Name them.
They're the American Warrior Initiative. We give service dogs to vets. It's awesome. We've been doing it for 6 years. But the more I worked in this area, the more I realized most Americans don't understand what our veterans go through on a day-to-day basis. And so I started trying to brainstorm ideas of how I could educate, you know, mainstream America about what makes the American warrior tick. And so I started thinking, you know, I've always loved fiction. I've loved it my whole life. It's always been a dream of mine to write fiction. Like, you know, I never thought I could actually do it. But then I started thinking, okay, probably one of the best, most effective ways I can help educate Americans on what makes the American warrior tick is by writing mainstream fiction and write a character that embodies the greatness that I witnessed in my soldiers on the battlefield every day. And that character is Eric Steele, right? So again, I'm a Pittsburgh guy. His last name is Steele. There is a coincidence there. I don't care how much you hate the Steelers. I love them.
I don't hate them. So much so that
America loves the Steelers, but I don't want to digress
Jerry
too much.
Jerry Jones is on the phone.
Well, so Eric Steele embodies the greatness of the American soldier on the battlefield. He's written in the image of my soldiers. And so he's a good guy. He's a good character. He wants to do right by not only the people that he serves with, but also by this country that he loves.
But you talk about, and it's admirable, you want to tell these stories that the American people and mostly the media, because the American people can't fly over to Afghanistan and see what's
correct,
going on.
Correct.
It's the media that's supposed to inform the public, and they aren't. But you didn't set the Eric Steele novels in the war. It's right. It's in this sort of spy sort of describe what the Alpha program is.
Yeah. So the Alpha program, I wrote the Alpha program in the image and structure of the U.S. Green Berets Special Forces. So U.S. Special Forces teams, there's a team assigned to a different geographic area of the globe. Every Special Forces team speaks that language and they immerse themselves in that culture. And their mission is foreign internal defense. So they specialize on training indigenous troops to take the fight to their corrupt governments to basically promulgate freedom all around the world. So the Alpha program is basically the singleton operator version of that, where the Alpha program is there are nine alphas, each responsible for a different geographic area of the globe. And those alphas are the most highly trained operators from every branch of government or every branch of the military in our country. And Eric Steele is the youngest alpha. And these alphas, once you make it into the Alpha program, once you make it through the rigorous training process,
you're wiped out of existence.
You're ghosted. Yeah, you're wiped out of existence. Your name is taken off the books. Your social security number is taken off the books. And you report directly to the president of the United States.
So they can have plausible deniability.
Correct.
Much like every girl I ever dated wants. They wipe me out of their existence. And they say, oh, I've never heard that name before.
Well, yes. Yeah, so Eric Steele was ghosted. He's brought into the Alpha program. He's the youngest, most talented alpha in American history. And the whole reason I came up with this is there were times in Afghanistan where we were in eastern Afghanistan in 2006. This was at a time where the eyes of the nation were wholeheartedly fixated on the Iraq war. We were sort of just left to handle it. And it was basically like our mission was to close with and destroy the enemy, find Osama bin Laden, capture or kill him. That was it. So there'd be times where we'd be sitting out there on random outposts in Afghanistan or traffic control points in Afghanistan, and we'd know where the high value target was. We'd know where the super, super bad guys were, right? But then we'd have to pass it up the chain of command. They'd have to talk to different areas of government. And then by the time the approval authority came down and we were given the green light to go get this guy, he'd already be gone. Right. And so it was the most maddening thing in the world, especially when you're in the midst of heavy combat and a counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, that is Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires. You want to take the fight to the enemy and win. We never really had that opportunity to go after high-value targets. We never had the flexibility to do it either. And so I just said, you know what? I'm going to create a fictional program that there's no bureaucratic red tape. The president says, go and fix a problem. Alphas are left to figure it out, fix the problem in any way that they see fit, as long as it's in keeping with the best interests of the United States. And so that's what the Alpha program is, and that's what Eric Steele is a part of.
So after Man of War, Eric Steele's in rough shape. He's seen better days.
He's lost a lot, yeah.
He's lost a lot, and physically, he's had the hell beat out of him.
He has.
And so we pick up right there. This is what, 6 months after?
6 months later, yeah. And so one of the things that I wanted to do with Eric Steele is not make him a superhero. Mm-hmm. Like when he gets hit, it hurts. He gets shot in the sappy plate in his body armor in the first book. He breaks his ribs. And this book picks up with him recertifying. And so, you know, if the Alpha program were a real U.S. government program, a soldier was wounded on the battlefield, he'd have to be retrained, recertified before he would be allowed to be operational again. And that's where this book picks up. And he recertifies, he passes recertification. And the first thing he does is go to have dinner with his mother. And all the while, like what I tried to do with Eric Steele is make him face the same dilemmas that our U.S. troops face on a day-to-day basis. And so what I mean by that is he constantly questions the mission. He says, you know, is the cost of this mission worth it? Like when we were in Afghanistan, I can't tell you how many times I asked myself, I got guys getting wounded, shot in the head every single day. Is this worth it?
What was your conclusion?
In Afghanistan, I concluded that it was, because there are little kids that are smarter today, smarter now than they were before we were there. There are little girls that can read now. And I think all of that bodes well for the future of the country if the populace is more educated. Are we winning the war there? It really depends what your definition of win is, or the definition of victory, because we win every battle that we're in on the battlefield, but somehow we're losing the war politically. So
is that because they say you can only go up to this point? The rules of engagement are such that,
yes,
if there's a possibility of one civilian casualty, then you can't do that mission.
Derek, I'll tell you right now, in 2006, I will take this to my grave. The war was won in Afghanistan in 2006, 2007. We had killed so many insurgents and high value targets that were there just in combat, just just from being there for 485 days, we were getting intelligence from the Pakistani Taliban. When we were listening to their communications on their ICOM radios of them, of the Pakistani Taliban and families in Pakistan saying, "We're done committing our sons to this fight. We're losing too many of them. We're done supporting you." And then we left. President Obama took office. The strategy changed from counterterror, which is close with destroy, kill the enemy, to counterinsurgency, where we're building combat outposts everywhere at largely static positions. And when that happened, it allowed the Pakistani Taliban to consolidate, reorganize, bolster, like get more troops for their mission and penetrate into the heart of Afghanistan. And after that happened, the war just became uncontrollable.
As is always the case, it's the people not in the fight who end up losing.
Well, we should have known that the Maginot Line didn't work, you know? And so just building a bunch of combat outposts in one of the most rugged areas in the face of the world, in the Hindu Kush Mountains, that rugged border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, I mean, why build a combat outpost when there are mountains that are 7,000 feet high between each one that insurgents – why would they walk past your outpost when they can just go two clicks to the south and walk right? I mean – you know, when you spread your force out along a line.
Because a bureaucrat justifying their
exactly
job
right.
in the Pentagon
That's
in Arlington.
Look, you're exactly right. They're looking at a map and they're saying, look how good this would work. And that was a colossal mistake for the war in Afghanistan, for the fight in Afghanistan. And in 2007, from 2007-2008, that was when the war started. That's when we started to lose. And let me highlight that point by saying, like, we were attacked – or the enemy tried to attack us. We built the very first combat outpost in Afghanistan at a place called Combat Outpost Margah, right on the border. The enemy tried to overrun us. We had 20 troops on the ground. They attacked us with over 300 enemy soldiers, 50 from the north, 50 coming in from the northwest, about 250 coming in directly from Pakistan. I have the Predator video of this to this day. We found them, we identified, and we killed every single one. Because our mission was to find the enemy and kill them. In the years that followed, every year that followed for the next 5 years in Afghanistan, an American platoon on a combat outpost was overrun. Every single year that followed. So we changed the mission in Afghanistan to the great detriment of not only U.S. policy goals there, but to the U.S. ground pounder in
Afghanistan.
You would think
that the brass would recognize that, hey, suddenly things are going south.
I'll tell you why they don't. Because the brass aren't the guys that have served in combat, right? They came up during the Cold War. They never actually fought in a kinetic fight. Think about it like this. Like if you're an artist and you've been trained to paint a painting, but you've never actually painted a painting, you're going to want to try to justify your career, right? Mm-hmm. And these generals who came up during the Cold War, most of them, not all of them, but most of them had never been in combat or had a bullet cracked by their head. These are the guys that are writing policy for the ground pounders in Afghanistan. So guys like me, who you would hope would stay in for a whole career, having went through nonstop combat for a long time, end up getting out because they're so frustrated with the freaking process of the rules and the policy errors that experienced combat leaders don't stay in. And the guy, it's just sort of a self-licking ice cream cone. People that have no combat experience end up in charge of combat ground pounders. The combat ground pounders get out because they're frustrated by the policy that's written by people that have never been there.
So we're a generation away of having those commanders replaced by people who actually have the experience and know what they're talking about?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, look, I would say, I don't want to criticize people that put on the uniform and serve a career. I would say most of your general officers, I say most of, not all, are people that have never been there before. Because think about it like this. I went into the military wanting to make it a career. I was medically retired as a captain because I was wounded and I had fractured my skull in a couple different places. I went in with lofty goals and experienced the heaviest combat that any U.S. military unit has been in before. And I got back from that and I was just thinking, to hell with this. I'm done. My nine lives are up. So most guys that are in combat like me do that. They get out. They want to start a family. They don't want to sacrifice anymore because they don't know that they're going to have the opportunity to start a family in the future or just do the things that they want to do. So what happens is all your experienced guys get out and all your career guys that have never been there, right? And I'm using the term all.
We're using broad generalizations,
yeah,
so but everybody knows there are exceptions to every rule.
Yeah, right there. Thank you. And so, yeah, most of the time, the guys that stay in are the guys that never been there, and those are the guys that write policy. So it's
cheery.
You see how it's like.
Well, right. Yeah. No.
The cycle never ends.
And working in the opinion world, there are people. I've had 72 jobs, I think, in my lifetime. I've had more jobs than most families have had. And so I've lived under a lot of the policies that I write about. there are a lot of people who've never done anything except write their opinion about policies they've never worked on, never worked in, never studied, or anything like that. And it's frustrating, and that it's not obviously as skull-crushing frustrating, although metaphorically.
What is frustrating? You know, I mean, you want the people that are opining on the world's greatest problems, so to speak, to actually have some life
some
experience.
Some first-hand knowledge,
yeah,
something.
Right.
And they don't in large cases. So you create an Eric Steele to get around that. He's sort of born of your frustration then.
Yes. Yes. And he's part of a program that doesn't have any of the issues that we just outlined. And so, you know, this genre itself is filled with guys that are like and the anti-hero. And I feel like anti-heroes are really popular today. I mean, and
you look hard drinking, hard
smoking. Hard drinking is PTSD.
Nobody gets past Macho Grande. Get over Macho Grande.
Well, right. And so Eric, from the very beginning is good. His idiosyncrasy, if you can call it that, is his goodness. And so as a storyteller and writer, the coolest, what I can do is put him in impossible situations.
At the beginning of All Out War, in the first couple of chapters, he's in a liquor store. And he's ready to kick the crap out of a guy because he's abusive. And you know, that's the kind of, he's the guy who sees the shit going down across the room and doesn't say, come on, honey, well, let's go out the back door. He says, I'm going to go and make this right or stop it from happening.
That's right. And so the theme in the first book, and I always like to write with moral questions and themes because I really think it's important to address certain aspects of our society. What the hell is the point of a story if you don't do that? Mm-hmm. And so Eric Steele, in the first book, he learns very clearly from his mentor, Demo, that you can't save everybody. Eric Steele, on every mission that he's a part of, if he's on a mission to find a nuclear bomb, a rogue nuclear weapon, if he sees a woman and child in Syria being raped, he always has a tactical acumen, strength, intelligence, whatever, to step in, save the girl, save the wife, and and accomplish the mission, right? But the problem is what if the mission is somebody that you love and care about, you know? In combat, as an American soldier on the battlefield, you're in those no-win situations all the time, Derek. What if a young girl in combat walks up to your Humvee with a grenade in her hands? Do you shoot that little girl or not? Ultimately, it's a no-win situation. I mean, the hope is that you have the patience that you can identify that maybe what she's bringing you is a dud grenade that she found in her front yard. But what if she's not? And so those are the kinds of situations that I want to put the reader in along the you know, with Eric Steele, in Eric Steele's hip pocket along the way. And in book two, I run him through the ringer in book two. He's got on the forefront of his mind, is the mission worth it? Is what I'm doing out there making this country safer and better? Which is, again, if you think about it, the American troops ask themselves that question all the time because, you know, spouses, husbands, wives, parents, soldiers aren't the only ones that deploy. You know, families bear the emotional scars of a deployment too. Well, in an all-out war, Eric Steele's wondering if the mission is worth it, wondering if he's on the right path. He's having dinner with his mother to discuss just that, and he's attacked at his home. His mom is critically injured. You don't know if at the end of this attack, if she's alive or dead. And now Steele's saying, Jesus Christ, you know, here I'm wondering if the mission is worth it, and now my mom herself has been wrapped up into it. And so, you know, from a symbolic standpoint, that's not unlike every mother that watches her son or daughter go to war. They bear the emotional scars. They might not be physical injuries, but they bear the emotional scars. And Steele's mom and her injuries are supposed to be emblematic of that fight.
I don't want to give too much away in the book, but I have read it or listened to the audio version because I can't read. I'm an illiterate. But it's excellent, and I highly recommend it. I want to talk to you about the process, and then you can give away as much as you want.
Yeah.
I can't ruin
your
book.
You're a trickster, man. You had me out of the lobby. You're getting me to disclose certain plot elements.
You
want to
know the secrets of the next few books. PayPal me some money. And we
yeah, right, exactly.
The detail of the scenarios is only matched by the details of the settings in some cases. Now, I'm just curious, as a reader and as a writer, not of fiction, but although some people think it's all BS that I write, did you go to these places to write about them?
Well, so what? No, it wasn't in the budget, right? But this book is all over the world.
Right.
I just did a ton of research on reading about the countries, the geographic layout of the countries, talking to people that have been there. And what I always say is, I just watched the very first X-Men, okay? Mm. At the end of that movie, Wolverine is fighting Sabretooth on top of the Statue of Liberty. Yeah. And I'm like, holy shit, whoever wrote that, I mean, that is awesome. Whoever wrote that, like, the writers are probably thinking this is going to be a badass scene, right? That's what I always try to do with my books, is have a badass scene in a cool location. But what makes those scenes so memorable is it's the vendetta between Wolverine and Sabretooth that really attached the viewer to those scenes. It really creates a sense of suspense as who's going to win. So I always say character.
Really. Gee, he's going to kill Wolverine. And
Sabretooth and Wolverine have a really complicated relationship. Right. What I'm trying to say, Derek, is that that scene important. So character is more important than setting, even though I do try to put a lot of time and effort into the settings and making sure they're authentic.
But you describe the characters are excellent, but when you're listening to it, you're seeing it just like you would anything else. It's like a movie in your head. It's. I swear to God, I thought that you went to these places.
I didn't.
The scenes in London. Did you at least go to London?
No, I've been there before. I've been to Europe as part of being in the army. But no, I've never been to London. But I'll tell you right now, I've got great editors that tell me that the Picatinny line is not the Picatinny train. You know, in the first draft, it was the Picatinny train. You know,
so you don't have to tell everybody you screwed up.
I screwed up a lot.
There's a team of people behind you fixing. All
creativity is collaborative. You know, and I don't give a shit what anyone says. If someone's writing a fiction book, you got help doing it. Look at Michael Crichton. Michael Crichton's one of the most prolific and best fiction authors ever. He wrote some of the most creative stories ever. But the guy wasn't an archaeologist. It wasn't expert on Amber. He had those members on his team helping teach, coach, and mentor him. I have a great editorial team that's helped me every step of the way with these books. I'm not ashamed to admit it. But I did a shitload of research on these locations. Is it okay if I swear? Is it all right to swear on the podcast?
No, it's not.
You can say whatever you want. I'm getting thumbs up from the producer.
Yeah, he likes it.
Yeah, he likes it. So I'm just saying, like, I did a lot of research, spoke to a lot of people that have actually been there. I let them read those actual chapters. I mean, I want to – with these books, authenticity is everything.
Yes.
And so I want to make sure that I get the small details right, both tactically and geographically.
When you sat down to write Man of War – was it, this is the story, or was it, this is the first act in a story? I'm just curious, when you sit down to write All Out War, do you sit down and go, okay, what am I going to do from where I left off last time? Or do you know the puzzle piece you have to fit into the mosaic that you're working on?
I think the answer to that is a little of column A, a little of column B. Man of War, to answer your first question, was not, I mean, oh my gosh. What you read on the pages of Man of War today is the fourth or fifth iteration of that story, of me just trying to learn the style of writing fiction. Moving from Outlaw Platoon, which is nonfiction, to trying to write a thriller story was monumentally challenging. Everybody loves the idea of writing fiction, but it is like learning to ride a bicycle without a seat while it's on fire. It is really hard. And I wrote four or five different beginnings, probably 100 pages into five different steel stories that my editor was like, this isn't quite right yet. Once I found that formula, once I found the right economy of words, that's the big thing with fiction. You have to have the right economy of words. You can't over-describe both character or setting because it makes the plot lag. So you just have to strike the right balance. Once I figured that out for Man of War, the process was a lot easier. But God, man, getting that first book done was a challenge. I feel like I came into book two in a more structured way. And once I had the story done, the characters done, their histories done, both their internal, all the characters' internal conflicts and external conflicts outlined, and the world was created, I sort of knew where I wanted to start with All Out War. And I knew what pieces of the puzzle I wanted to make sure I clipped into place.
How hard is it when you sit down and you write and you have this outline, you have this idea, you have these characters, and then you're like halfway through it, you're like, oh, crap, I forgot about this. And, you know, this important thing or this good idea that I had. And either you got to scrap it or you got to go back and find a way to weave it in.
Well, it's really hard because it's like once weaving in a subplot, it's not easy, you know, because subplots are they're chain reactions. One thing affects the other. It's real life. So the way I write these books is I come up with four or five kick-ass action sequences, like the most original action sequences, scene, setting, tactics that you could possibly imagine, and I use them in waypoints for my story. So I've come up with these, and I outline, do a deep dive on all of these action scenes, and I write to each waypoint. And so from those action scenes, I can develop an outline, basically a map of where I want to take the story. But the truth of the matter is, if you're a good fiction writer, right? And your characters are real people, and these are real people in my mind. Characters have a say in where a story goes. So sometimes as you write, the writing process is sort of a fly by the seat of your pants.
You know what? I had him doing this, but now that he's here, he wouldn't do that.
Yes, exactly. So the characters get a say in how they get from point A to point B to point C. And so I feel like I have that battle rhythm down now. And I feel like, you know, that is why for young writers, it's so important to have a theme and a moral question. Every line of dialogue for every character that you have, if it's not serving the broader theme, then it's wasted dialogue. In other words, the theme in All Out War, and I just say this because most people probably won't realize that themes and moral questions are oftentimes unconscious things. They just we just know we like a story when we leave a movie or read a book just because. But the theme in All Out War, right, is are you a man or are you a slave? And what I tried to do with Eric Steele and Zakayev, the villain in this story, is they both are essentially the same character. They both are operators for their own government. They both have done the bidding of their own government. They both have tried to protect their own governments. But the difference is, and what Eric Steele, I think, realizes in the end of this story, is the altruism that's a part of his mission, right? The fact that he is out there trying to liberate other people, trying to save other people. And it's and what he does is a choice, which makes him a servant, not a slave. He does it by choice, right? And that plays back into the, is the mission worth it? For Zakayev, he just resents the fact that he's been used and abused the whole time, and he's been a pawn, and he just wants to kill the kings, right? And so—
But that wasn't—he was hired for a gig.
He was, and but then, he had his own ulterior motives from the very beginning.
But
yes.
It's an interesting way to use the main villain, is you sit there and then about halfway through, you're like, wait a second, is he not the main villain? Is he a mercenary?
Yeah.
What's going on? And then
Zakayev from the very first chapter has his own ulterior motives. And I thought that was important to me.
He's not one-dimensional or even two-dimensional. He's three-dimensional. He's a very interesting character.
In a perfect world, I love the villain almost as much as I love the hero.
You're a horrible person at your heart, at your core. You're a bad man.
Well, you know, what can I say? I like a good villain, you know? And Zakayev is a character that has been used and abused his whole life, and he's pissed off at the people that have done it, you know? And all, his mission is to take out the kings. He's been a pawn his whole life. He wants to kill the kings. And Eric Steele, after his mother gets hurt, you know, in this book, his mother gets hurt. Eric Steele is on a mission to kick ass and take names and find the people that hurt his mother and kill them all. But in doing so, he gets dragged into a much larger conspiracy.
Can I give away?
You could talk about whatever you want.
I'm going to set the ball on the tee, and you can decide how much to give away. But one of the things I really liked about this was the idea. Cold storage.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I love the concept of it, and the name is perfect and everything.
Thank you.
But I found myself going, God, I wish this was real. I wish this was real.
Yeah, thank you. That's so cool. I love that you love that, man. So black site prisons were a big item of contention during the George W. Bush administration. Yes. CIA, black site prisons. They're all
God forbid we take people places where we can get information from them.
The global war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan was at its height. We had black site prisons outside the continental United States where they didn't necessarily have to adhere to constitutional law. Well, all of those went away, and I'm using air quotes, they went away.
They better not have gone away.
And so I just start thinking, like, what would be the most badass way to create a prison to get around all the bullshit that George W. Bush and then Barack Obama after him had to deal with the controversy of the black site prisons? The best way to do it is, like, what if I had a nuclear-powered icebreaker ship that all it did was circumnavigate the North Pole on shipping routes that are swamped with Russian ships. I did so much research on Russian shipping and shipping out of Murmansk and Arctic shipping lanes. This ship could circumnavigate the Arctic Circle up at the North Pole on shipping lanes that are already there, hide in plain sight, and nobody would be – nobody would know the difference. It's a ship that houses the worst terrorists on the face of the planet, people that don't want to go – you don't want sending to Guantanamo Bay. They're too dangerous to send there. They just put them there for the rest of their life. and they try to exploit intel from them, and nobody knows why. It's in international waters. Is it a U.S. ship? I don't know. But you get all that information in this book. I'm really psyched about that idea. And cold storage, by the way, is so it's kind of a cool name with double meaning. Cold storage is where you put all of your weapons in the military. Like, hey, go get your equipment out from cold storage. I'd tell my squad leaders or whatever, oh, you know, put your equipment in cold storage. That's what we would call it. So I'm like, that would be a badass name for a black site prison that I wanted
it's
to put.
So much, it's like, how pissed are you that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is still alive and hasn't even
been tried? Well, why isn't he on cold storage?
He wants to plead guilty.
Come on.
No, why isn't he cold? Why isn't he room temperature?
Exactly. Why is he still alive? Or why is he in New York City? Why does he get the benefits of constitutional law? Why does he get an attorney? He was captured on the battlefield.
And
killed American troops.
He admitted what he did. He's proud of it.
Look, we're at war. I mean, he should not. He's not a U.S. citizen. He should not be subject to the same constitutional protections that U.S. citizens are subject to. It's an insult. It's a slap in the face to what the founding fathers intended. We're at war. These people want to kill us. Why is he in a jail cell and in some supermax prison in New York City? I don't know. It's wrong.
Let me ask you again about the book and the... There's a lot of weapon use. There's a lot of descriptions of the weapons. Is that from firsthand? Do you do research on that?
You
haven't gone to Budapest, or
I do know my right. No Budapest, no Tunis, but I do love weapons, and so I love 1911s. I've been obsessed with that pistol for a long time. I wanted Steele to carry that as a remnant of his relationship with his father. Eric Steele's father disappeared when he was really, really young on a mission. Eric Steele doesn't know what happened to him, but all he's left to remember his father by is this 1911 pistol. And so I just love the history of the 1911 pistol. It's basically, I look at a 1911 pistol and that just screams to me U.S. military, right? That's what we were issued all the way back, going back to World War I. So, and yeah, every rifle in this book is a rifle that I've, you know, for the most part, I've fired on my own, you know, or carried in battle, or one of my men carried in battle, you know, where I might not have been a subject matter expert on that particular weapon system. I knew all the technical specifics of it because I was in charge of the guys who wielded it.
I want to meet Meg.
Meg, you like her? You think she's sexy?
I don't know. I haven't seen her, but I like the description.
Why do you want to meet her?
She's a badass. She's smart. Eric Steele, because Eric Steele has a well-rounded life.
He does.
Under normal circumstances.
He does.
But he's not this super guy where he's minding his own business and then the beeper goes off, gets the call, and immediately he jets off to the other side of the world.
Right. That's what I said. That's not what Eric Steele is. Yeah, Eric Steele, you know, he has a lot of the same daily problems that we do. And he's got a thing for Meg and Meg has a thing for him. But again, this is something that I draw right from my military experience. It's not only is Eric questioning the mission, Meg is questioning the mission. Can I have a relationship with a guy who's gone all the time?
In situations where he's likely to get killed. And not even possibly could get killed. He's likely to get killed. That's his job.
And never see him again and not know what happened to him. Right. And so Meg is even questioning, can I handle this? Can I get married to this man? Can I have a life with this man? Can I have kids with this man? What happens if he goes overseas and goes on a mission and never comes back? And so all these things are on her head too, on her mind as well. And, you know, I think now more than ever, I have to say Meg was a character that I think is important because, you know, I watch my daughter, she's 8. And she watches these Pixar films like Brave, or anytime there's a kick-ass female hero that just really does just kick ass and take names. You see her liven up after watching those films. And there's nothing greater than seeing her like think that she can do those things. Meg is a character written for her. You know, I want my daughter to think that she can kick ass and take names. And that's why Meg is in this book.
Which is harder to write, fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction 1,000 times over.
Which do you like writing more?
Fiction 1,000 times over. Yeah, fiction is so fun. Oh my gosh, it's so tedious and it's so challenging. It really, really is. And you truly have to love the process of creating a story and wargaming different scenarios and creating characters. I just think that there is nothing more fun, but also nothing more challenging.
Tom Clancy was famous for his descriptions and descriptions of the technology, much of which the military said, hey, that's a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Let's go try and do that. You have some of that in here.
Yeah.
The imagination part, how do you balance the I could create some sort of super weapon or super drone or whatever yeah. with the, I've got to keep it in the realm of reality.
Yeah,
you got to be out ahead of it.
You do.
A little bit, but not ridiculously so that there are flying cars.
Right. No, you're really touching on some really important things. Yeah. My job, I feel like, is I look at these books as faction. Yes, they're fiction, but they're based in a world of fact. You know, one of the key plot elements of this book is the U.S. Embassy move in Israel to Jerusalem. That I turned in this manuscript before Donald Trump made that call. You know,
you're a witch. Burn so, him.
Well, you know, Burn it's him. Like you look at where the political winds are blowing, and you're trying to say if we're going to stay on this path, like we might end up here, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm not. And weapons are the same thing. You know, I try to look at where we are. I know when I got out of the military, they had a heads up display helmet, sort of like Halo, Master Chief in Halo, where you would have your azimuth, you'd have your 8-digit grid coordinate, it would monitor your health. And so I wrote that in book one. It was a Mark 11 jumper's helmet that helped Eric Steele do a Halo jump into Beirut. In this book, it's this thing I just made up off the top of my head called the Operator Life Support System, which is a body armor, but it also doubles at monitoring vital. It doubles at monitoring
your
vital.
It can give you a heart shock.
Yeah, right. And so it is really important to look at existing technology and figure out, you know, where we're going to go next or what would be the most beneficial thing to a U.S. soldier or a U.S. operator on the battlefield, you know? And look, we have Fitbits. We have the technology to do it. We could probably strap body armor to soldiers right now that monitored vitals and could administer a shock should a soldier go into cardiac arrest. Why can't that be real? Mm-hmm. And so you just sort of try to take what's out there already and elevate it a little bit and you know, walk 2 or 3 years down the line and say, this is where we could be. And that's really what I try to do with these books.
Coming up with names. How hard is that? The times I've written short stories, it's like the villain is douchebaggy, whatever. And then the hero is me.
Yeah.
It's hard to come up with names. I've had two daughters. We named them both. I came up with both the names. That was an impossible process.
It's hard.
But you create an entire world where you want a good name. You want a great name, but you don't want it. Like when somebody hears it, they go, that's just too on the nose. You got to make it kind of realistic that you might meet this guy at the bar or something.
Yeah. Well, so I can tell you what I did for Eric Steele. And by the way, all of these names were names that I had on my mind for years.
You used to dream about a guy named Eric Steele when you were a child?
Well, so I always loved the last name.
Talk about your childhood.
I wasn't dreaming about him as a child, but you know, I Eric Steele was a guy that I always loved that last name. And I remember, like, right after we got extended in Afghanistan, you know, again, I always wanted to write fiction. I always wanted to do that. I've always loved fiction. Never thought I would ever be able to do it or accomplish it. But I remember seeing the new brigade commander that came in. His last name was Steele, Steele, spelled just like my character. He was like 6'8", 300 pounds. And I'm like, holy shit. If somehow I make it out of this country alive. And I have the opportunity to write a book. I'm gonna bust my ass to try to write a book every day, but that is gonna be my main character's name. And I started thinking, I'm like, well, this is perfect. I'm from the Steel City. This is perfect. And so Steel is a Pittsburgh guy, but
then you write it down and you think, but I run the risk of Steel. He's a tough guy. Like, is this too cheesy? Where it could have been like Chase Steel or something. That would have been too much. Eric kind of softens it a little bit, but there is that Blake Steel here.
Yeah.
You know?
Blaze Steel. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Forged Steel is his name. Yeah, I know. I worried about that for a little bit, but then I just got to a point where I was just like, the hell with it. I don't care. I don't care if people think it's cheesy. But I mean, even Rockford.
President's names.
Rockford and Cole. President Cole's named after one of my soldiers in Afghanistan that I lost. Zakayev is a character that I've had in my mind for the last 5 years. You know, I always wanted to write a Chechen terrorist. You know, that
why do you hate Chechens?
I think they're badass. We fought them in Afghanistan, and they were some of the toughest, most tenacious light infantry men that you'd ever fight. I mean, they were just they were amazing. You know, your average Chechen soldier has 10 or 15 years combat experience on an American soldier, not young 18-year-old private. I mean, and so I always thought, man, you know, a Chechen super terrorist would be a a really, really great villain. And, you know, oftentimes these Chechens, like, yeah, they're Muslim, but they aren't hardliners at all. They're just straight killers. And so I've yet to see a Chechen villain, a free thinking villain that wasn't a slave to some sort of ideology in a book before. It just hasn't happened. So that's what Zakayev is. I mean, he's just, I've had that name on my mind for a very, very long time. So
it's very, very interesting. We're out of time. The book is All Out War. I'm going to ask you to sign these.
And I will.
I want you to sign that as well for me. And you can enter to win if you send me a copy of the receipt that you bought this already. You get entered twice for the signed copy. So you get that going for you. Sean Parnell, All Out War, best of luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you, man. And I hope we'll be back for the three-peat next year.
Right. Off camera. I know what's going to happen, I think. Yeah. Maybe not. I don't know. But I'd recommend this book highly. And tell me about this guy who does your audiobook.
Oh, R.C. Bray is amazing. I don't know
awesome.
Why.
He's awesome.
I say it all the time.
Get the audiobook.
He's amazing. I got to say, he brings Man of War and All Out War to life. He is an award-winning audiobook reader, and I don't think that there is any other person in the world better than he is at reading fiction. And he reads my books. He's dedicated to Eric Steele and his saga, and oh man, I'm lucky to have him. He's great. And the audiobooks, they really are. This isn't me just like pimping my own product, but
no,
he really does bring the story to life. I mean,
Harper
he does.
Is my publisher as well. They sent me the advance of the audio, and I loved it so much, I would find myself spending more time in the car because I was listening in the car. You can't; it's on my phone, so I couldn't listen to it at home very well. That I bought Man of War,
dude. That's
audio
awesome.
Version,
and it's great.
This guy's doing it too.
Yeah,
I want that too.
R.C. Bray's amazing. I can't thank him enough for all the great work that he does for me. And he, like I said, he brings Eric Steele and all of his adventures to life for sure.
Well, you do that.
I try my best. It's like, I feel like R.C. Bray really just elevates the story in
seriously,
some really
though,
critical
ways. If they're like Oscars for audiobooks.
He would be the best.
Absolutely
yeah.
Do it. Sean Parnell, the book All Out War. Best of luck to
thanks,
you, my
man.
Friend.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming
to town. I'll
be back
next year, whether you want me or not.
Well, we'll see.
Maybe drinking something a little cooler than Bud Light.
Maybe you'll have to bring down some of that Leinenkugel swill with yourself, because DC has standards and we don't allow it here. Thanks for watching. Thanks for telling a friend. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
Well, it is Monday. I'm back now. It is Monday. It is Veterans Day. And I thought, why not salute veterans with the veteran that we had on the show a couple of times, Sean Parnell, possibly, hopefully, maybe, one of the next members of Congress next year. I suggest you pick up his books. I suggest you follow him on Twitter at Sean Parnell USA. I suggest you do some research and see if maybe he's the kind of candidate you could be proud of and maybe want to support. Whatever you want to do, you can't go wrong with Sean. He's just an all-around good dude. Anyway, happy Veterans Day to every veteran out there. We'll be back to normal format tomorrow. Tuesday. I will be on the radio on WCBM in Baltimore or WCBM.com everywhere around the world from 9 a.m. till noon today and every day Eastern time. So if you didn't get enough of me babbling in your ears in the podcast, you can do that as well. Email me, Derek at dailycaller.com. The website to contribute is patreon.com/TheDerekHunterPodcast or Derek/DerekHunterPodcast. Whatever. I don't even know. Thank you again, and we'll be back to normal tomorrow.